This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 20th of May, 2012. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 150, with me, Robert Bound, and Steve Bloomfield. On this week's show, we'll be joined by Isabelle Ligeron, First Lady of French Wine and committed spokesperson for artisan winemakers.
We'll be talking to indie rocker Tim Burgess about why independent record labels still offer the most sought-after sounds. And we'll be talking to architecture and design specialist Lucinda Lambton about their often overlooked speciality, the art of creating the perfect toilet.
All that plus some perfectly chosen songs that I carried back from Cuba, all here in the next hour on the Monocle Weekly. Time flies when you're having fun, Steve. 150 shows, can you believe it?
I really can, yeah.
That was the response I was expecting.
No, I can't believe it. No, I can't believe it. It's felt like it's been on for a while now.
Yeah, it has. 3 years. I don't know if it's a roller coaster or a, what do they call it? A bulldozer. Maybe it's a bulldozer.
That's different from a roller coaster, really, isn't it?
It's bull something.
Yes. no, yeah, we started never on the
off,
weekly.
We started off in the sound company in sort of just down the road, just off Great Portland Street. Mm. Tyler, Andrew, and I hatched some audio plans in a slightly less salubrious surroundings than that.
Very much so,
here,
yeah.
At Midori House, and it's sort of slowly evolved.
I remember
it
listening
sort of got
to the
big,
first one.
And it sort of contracted, did you?
Yeah. In Nairobi on very bad internet.
Really, was it? Like,
there was a lot of waiting for to buffer and rebuffer.
That's where that genre of music called glitchtronica comes from. It's from basically people with dial-up who are trying to listen to or download something from iTunes.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Essentially where it comes from. So things have sort of expanded, contracted, and now there are sort of two. I think this is nice, Steve. I kind of, who cares?
A two-man weekly.
Exactly. It's all right. Two-man weekly. We can pull. So we've got a kind of rope in here. It's like a push-me-pull-you. Push-me-pull-you. It's like a seesaw.
Yes.
See something.
And I saw something. It's going to work. It'll be fine.
I think it's a good show. I think I like it streamlined now, right?
Yes.
We've got it streamlined. Tim Burgess, he's one of my great heroes. It's great to have the lead singer of the Charlatans on.
Yes.
He's going to be good.
He's going to be fantastic. I went to see the Charlatans once at a secret gig in Liverpool about 10 years ago.
Was it so secret it was actually outdoors but they were playing incredibly quietly? It was like a mime act.
It was one of these things. It was a friend of mine just said, I've got these tickets for something. It's like, what is it? It says, I can't tell you.
But presumably it wasn't that secret, yeah. Just in case you said something.
But they were brilliant. It was a special show for, you know, for their fans and me. I mean, obviously I was a fan, but not the sort of fan that would necessarily know about a secret gig. And they were brilliant.
He's a good boy, isn't he?
He really is, yeah.
And Lucinda Lambton, again, she's I adore her. I adore her TV programmes here on British TV. She sort of reminds me of sort of like the female Jonathan Meads or something. Mm. Like, you know, someone that's a bit of a polymath, architecturally kind of inclined polymath. So it'd be good to talk to her about bogs.
Exactly, yes. When we were thinking who could we possibly have on to talk toilets, you know, she was the first
one
name
woman
that,
springs to mind.
That came to
I
mind.
Could have happily talked about it. They're kind of a predilection of mine. But let's not get into that.
I was about to tell a toilet anecdote.
Let's not go there.
No, it's a safe one. It's fine.
Okay.
No, it's all right. It's fine.
Let's leave it for Lucinda.
Yes.
Let's let her pick the nuts out of that one. That's terrible.
It really is.
We should get our first guest in, shouldn't we?
Yeah, why not?
I think we can have a wine tasting. We're drinking Cokes. It's not good for your delivery, is it? A lot of kind of gas. But we've
got water as well.
We'll filter it down with some wine.
Yeah.
So we'll have Isabelle Ligeron coming up next.
Our first guest is a wine expert in a long family line, having been raised on a vineyard as a sixth generation of a cognac-producing family in her native France. She's that nation's only female Master of Wine, a title held by less than 300 people worldwide, and this weekend in London's Old Truman Brewery, she's been hosting the Raw Wine Fair, a festival dedicated to celebrating artisan wine from around the world. Isabelle Ligeron, welcome to Monocle Weekly.
Yeah, thank you. Very exciting.
Very exciting for you, for you to be here, coming in with a suitcase, literally a suitcase full of wine.
Yes, I often travel with a suitcase full of wine. I have to say it's the hazard of the job.
It beats a brown paper bag.
Yes,
that's true.
Exactly, it has a certain style, and you've already sort of unloaded some things from your suitcase. Do you want to Before we get into what you've unloaded, tell us a little bit about the weekend's fair and what sort of brought you here.
Well, the fair shows some 200 wine growers from all over the world. Essentially, I mean, we've got a large representation from France, from Italy, but then they're coming from Serbia, Georgia, Croatia, Slovenia, Australia, New Zealand. I mean, there's a whole bunch of people. And they all share one philosophy, which is they all farm their vines organically and or biodynamically. And then when the grapes hit the vineyard, they actually use very, very little additives, if any. And maximum really is a dash of sulfites, basically, which is added during the winemaking or at the bottling stage. And that might sound like, well, you know, so what? Because that's probably how all wines are made. But actually, that's pretty extraordinary, because I'd say that a lot of wines, you know, currently are made using, you know, quite a large amount of additives and processes and so on.
And what sort of difference does it make in terms of taste then? I mean, we'll come on to obviously taste them ourselves anyway in a moment, I'm sure. But
I mean, sometimes it doesn't actually make any difference. But a lot of the time, I'd say that, you know, the colour can be a little bit cloudy because these wines tend to be unfined and unfiltered. Mm. So you tend to have more texture and maybe some very fine, you'll see in the wines we're tasting, you'll see some maybe fine particles sort of, you know, in the wine, which for me is even better because it's more wholesome. And in the taste profile, when the wine has been made without any sulfites added whatsoever, then, and you've seen some of the wines, they can be maybe a little different, a little bit more expressive, or they can change from day to day. But for me, I find they have way more personality and they're really alive.
Do they? Is it? It sounds like this is how wine was made before the 20th century, I guess, before pesticides and insecticides and sort of the mass production of stuff. Is it? Are we kind of getting a window into what wine used to taste like?
Yeah, it's a little bit, I'd say it is going back to how wine used to be made before we started using, you know, yeasts, adding yeasts and vitamins and enzymes and oak chips and all that stuff, which really started in, you know, 70s, 80s.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, and is it because the world of wine, do you feel that there's a homogenization of flavour, the Robert Parkerization of wine, I guess it's been called?
Yes, I mean, that's a really great point. And, yeah, you know, that's how I got into these wines, is that, to be honest, I was getting really bored of wine always tasting the same, you know, whether the wine was coming from a sunny place or in Chile or south of France or Spain. You know, sometimes I found the wine was always very similar, and that's because they use similar techniques. And I was through this kind of boredom and desire to discover other stuff in my industry, I kind of stumbled across kind of almost a parallel world in wine.
Okay. Shall we have a drop before,
yeah, sure,
we move on?
Great.
What have we got first, Isabel?
Okay, so I think the first one, I'm going to get you started sort of, you know, sort of the hardcore way.
She was born on a vineyard, can you guess?
Okay, guys, so the thing is with natural wines, particularly, you know, the first one I'm showing you, mm-hmm, this comes from Sicily. It's a great producer called Cornelissen, and who has vines on Mount Etna. So very, very typical, very, very unusual sort of volcanic soil. Mm. This was made, you'll see, look, when I pour it, look at that.
Oh yeah,
it's orange.
Yeah,
quite luminous.
That is bright.
Yeah,
it looks like a sort of russet cider, doesn't it? It's got a
it's got quite a
cloudiness
deep,
to it.
It's got quite a deep color, absolutely. And there is that kind of slight cloudiness in the wine. And so this is, you know, I've brought you all three colors. So this
brilliant.
This is orange wine. And that's it's.
Oh yes, I had this at this place in New York. Orange wine. Okay, I tried this, and this is...
Go on. Oh, yeah. So it's made indigenous Sicilian grape varieties. It's called Mungebel from 2010. And it's been macerated on the skins, which is why you have this kind of colour to the wine, which is quite unusual, which is very golden, almost orange. That's why we call them orange wines. Not been fine filtered. There's absolutely nothing added to the wine.
Is this something like a... It's got a pale oak flavour to it, but it's quite citrusy. How would you describe it, Isabel?
It's very citrusy. I mean, it's like this has been made in a plastic tank, so there's actually no oak whatsoever.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the first thing that hits you is that kind of there's a really bright acidity, which is really coming from the volcanic soil, and then very marmalade-y, lime-like, a little bit spicy. And, you know, quite unusual. And the thing, I think, with what's great with natural wines, and particularly examples like this, is that, you know, it really forces people to keep an open mind. Mm. You know, you need to forget what you think, maybe you what you think wine ought to taste like, with all these really zippy, limey, you know, kind of asparagus-y flavours, and enter a different world. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's lovely. It's sort of... I'm gonna use the term vino verde. It kind of sounds. It's got a kind of young, really youngness, youth to it as well. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say? You're the master of wine, Isabel. But it feels it's really lovely, and it's strange. It's strange having the cloudiness to it. Mm. But I suppose no two bottles are the same. That's presumably one of the points of artisan wine, or especially the vintages are very different.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You need to look at these wines as a fresh produce. You know, now we look at wines as like you just bottle it and you plump it somewhere and you forget it for years and you think, oh, it's not going to move. And a lot of the time, that's actually true. But when you look at these wines, you know, they need to, I guess, you need to take a little bit more care over them and maybe, you know, keep them in somewhere a bit cooler, for example.
Yeah. And so these, I mean, something like this, is this, I mean, how old is this?
This is 2010.
This is
so 2010. It's like just, I mean, this is the current vintage.
Yeah.
And it ages beautifully.
Does it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's the thing, because people say, you know, if you don't have any sulfites added to the wine, then there's less ageability.
Mm-hmm.
But like in the case of this one, that's not true at all.
How many bottles would be made of this? I mean, is there a...
You're going to get a... I'm sure there's more than a case, Steve.
It's more than a case.
No,
but,
I mean, but it, actually, is, are they, you know, because...
Tiny.
You know, quite small
tiny
amounts, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, for example, in the UK, I think there were about 6 magnums that made it over here. So it's a small... It'll be a few hundred bottles over here for sure. But it's, you know, this is really not mass production.
No.
And can you remind us of the name of that one again?
Yeah, so this is Cornelissen. Mungibel Bianco, and that's the number 7, which is from 2010 vintage, from Sicily on Mount Etna in Italy.
The most fertile soil imaginable to grow vines on, I should imagine.
Yeah, and essentially it's all about the volcanic soils are great at bringing up minerality in wine, so you can taste that in this.
No, you certainly can.
We've got to polish this off, haven't we, before the next one?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, we didn't bring in enough glasses. We'll just have to finish these.
Just have to glug this.
Empty this and to make
space.
I want
to hear some... noises
okay.
We'll do that.
We'll do that. Yeah. Sorry, we didn't taste it as professionally as we perhaps should have.
No, no, it's not that. It's just you get a lot more aromatic intensity if you just draw air through it.
Mm.
See?
It's your teeth like that.
Yeah. Like a mouthwash.
I almost did a burp on the radio, but it's fine. I didn't.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
It's all in control.
So I've got it under control. We're fine.
Okay.
Here.
Cool. So let's move on to the next one.
Okay.
So if you pass your glasses.
Thank you.
Shall I pour you a bit less then?
No, that's
no?
Right.
No, okay.
It's a Sunday. It's a Sunday. We've got nothing else to do.
That's true. That's true. Just going for brunch and then that's
pub
it.
Lunch?
Yeah, why not?
Good.
Okay, so we are in the south of France. Okay.
Great.
Here in the Roussillon.
Mm-hmm.
So not very far off Perpignan, kind of inland from Perpignan. And this is Domaine Vinci Collade. Is the name of the wine. It's a blend of Grenache Gris, Grenache Blanc and Carignan. And the south of France is a really exciting place. I mean, not only because obviously it looks really beautiful, but because they are a lot of, I mean, I think it's one of the largest area under organic sort of viticulture anyway.
Mm.
But it's home to a lot of very adventurous people. And you get a lot of great funky stuff coming out of there. People who are taking risks, including this. I mean, this is a really long-lived wine. This is the 2007 at the moment. And that would be decantable. I would decant that.
You would?
Okay. Yeah.
And this looks more like, you know, normal wine, if we can call normal wine normal wine, doesn't it?
It's got a colour of a sort of like an Alsace wine or something.
Yeah, it's like exactly, it's deep gold, a little bit of a green tinge, but you know, it's not been fined or filtered either, and it's quite smoky. You know, this is why you know, that kind of slight smokiness. I think you could, if you decanted it, you get rid of that, and then the wine would kind of open up and show a lot more.
This is to get more air into
it, like, more acacia and.
I'm trying to keep my mouth as open as possible while I drink it. That's not to get as much in as possible. I'm trying to aerate it. I'm just taking lessons from the master of wine, Steve. That's fine.
You're taking them very well.
Yeah. I know. I'm a very quick learner.
But perhaps do drink with your mouth closed.
So you see, brilliant acidity. I mean, it's quite an opulent, you know. You know, I think the winter's come back to London, so it's time to sort of go back to drinking kind of more.
No, the winter's not coming back.
It's got a, I don't know. it smells a bit in a good way. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like a it's like putting on your favourite coat in a cupboard on the first day of winter, and you hate the winter, but you put this coat on. It's got a sort of like gothic dark sort of flavour to it, which belies its golden colour. I'd have said it's kind of like a it's got a pleasant dustiness to it. Mm. I don't know.
Mm. No, it does. I can't add to that.
Isabel's literally just Isabel, come back. Sorry for calling it that. Sorry.
No, I think dusty, what's right, beautiful is like it's almost like beeswax. Mm. You know, it's very spicy aniseeds, like garrigue herbs. Mm. Mm. You know, that kind of very very southern French, kind of flavors. I mean, you know, this it goes really well with a lot of stuff, but on its own, I think it's really delicious.
We're going now to have a song while we rack up the next bottle, while we pop the cork on the next bottle. We're with Isabel Legeron, master of wine and head honcho at this weekend's Raw Festival at the Truman Brewery. I went to Cuba. I came back from Cuba this week.
Yeah.
I brought some CDs back with me. I hung out with Giles Peterson, who's made this great record called Havana Cultura Presents. Giles Peterson Presents Havana Cultura. We're going to play the first track off the first CD, because they're all so good, you can play it at random. And this is his own band, Giles Peterson's Havana Cultura Band. And this is Orisa, featuring Dreiser and Sexto Mundo. Who likes Orisa featuring Dreiser and Sisto Sentindo? There's a lot of words in that. And we've had a couple of glasses of wine.
Are you just
wine.
Saying that, you know, I would have assumed, having had, you know, a few days in Havana, you'd have come back with perfect Spanish?
I came back with a lisp. I think it's because of all the mojitos I drank.
And suntan.
To misquote Jarvis Cocker, I think I left a bit of my brain in a field in Havana. Anyway, that was from Giles Peterson's new album, which is Havana Cultura. We're with Isabel Legeron, master of wine, who's come in with three handsome-looking bottles of wine. We've tasted two.
And we did just establish, while we were listening to Giles Peterson, that last white did smell like Ryvita.
Yes.
in a very good way.
And before we crack that third bottle, Isabel, mm-hmm. I wonder where... Where's the sort of hotspot geographically for these artisan wines, these wines made with natural processes? Is France the biggest producer, or is it the new
France? No, France and Italy, mm-hmm. I think, by far. And then you're seeing more and more of it coming out of Australia, South Africa. But I think, you know, because, you know, Europe has been the sort of the traditional, you know, winemaking regions, and there's a big comeback to tradition. And as a result, I think there are a lot more people doing that in Europe. In the new world, like in Australia, you are seeing people who are rediscovering, you know, the sense of terroir and who are going for more of a hands-off sort of operation. But you know, I'd say France and Italy. I mean, I'd say probably about 50% of the fair is made up of Italians and French.
Yeah. And are you finding it increasingly easy to find, you know, in shops, in supermarkets or in specialist places, whether you're, you know, in Sydney or New York or here in London?
Absolutely. I mean, I think supermarkets might be, well, I guess, like an example like Whole Foods probably would be quite an interesting one, because they've got a very large selection. Supermarkets might be a bit sort of, you know, of an exaggeration, I think, not yet, because of their scale. They're very small producer, you know, small volumes. But otherwise, yes, bars are popping out everywhere. If you go to France, any local village will probably have a natural wine bar or a shop or selling, you know, wines from the local producers. So it's more and more easy to sort of, you know, grab a bottle.
And I was going to ask, I wondered about the sort of, we're so familiar with some of the big names in, well, French wine. Do, you know, big fashion designers, in order to become trendy, have diffusion lines, don't they, which are aimed at like younger people, or it's a cheaper market, or it's a more upscale market. Do the Louis Latours and Georges de Beauf of this world do artisan wines in small quantities to compete with these things, or are they two separate worlds?
I mean, I think, you know, the term natural is not really protected, or it's not defined.
Yeah.
So it's totally open to abuse. And I have seen some larger sort of operations start to use the word natural or naturae, or which kind of like leads, you know, the consumer on. It's a bit of green bashing.
It's made of something that was once alive. Yes. We can guarantee that. Okay.
So yeah, I mean, the key, look, what we're trying to do at the fair is not, you know, I think, you know, there's a place in the market for any styles of wines, whether it's wines made without any sulfites or wines that are a lot more heavily sort of manipulated. The key for me is that the consumer needs to know, and we need to find a way of communicating that on the label. We need to have a lot more transparency, because at the moment you grab a bottle of wine and you have no idea what's in that bottle. And that's what, you know, that's what the fair is about. Is, and on at the fair, you'll see if you open the catalogue, all the wines will mention total levels of sulfites, if the wine's been fined or filtered with perhaps, you know, egg white, which a small minority have, and then they're not suitable for you know, for vegetarians. And that's important to know, I think.
Shall we crack open the third?
Let's have a look at that, yeah.
What's it? Oh, sorry, you want our glasses, don't you?
Yeah, I want to try and do damage control on your beautiful...
studio carpet.
Oh, it's a red. We'll be very careful, don't worry.
Be careful. Okay, so the next wine is... so we're still in the Sud de France area. We're in the Languedoc, in an area called Corbière. Now, Corbière, so this is a guy called Xavier Ledogard. Mm-hmm. This is 2006. Corbière Boutenac. So this is a Carignan-dominated blend. I mean, this is, again, you know, quite full-on, very sort of leathery style. I mean, this is sort of like perfect, you know, Sunday roast material, I think. You know, you would decant it, probably just to get it a bit more relaxed. And the Languedoc is like the Roussillon, is home to sort of really, really beautiful vines that are surrounded by wild forests and garrigues. And
yeah, Corbière is always, it seems to be, it's kind of, it's wholehearted. It seems like it's baked. It's hot. It always tastes like it comes from somewhere very hot and dry. Corbière. It's got that kind of quality to it. This is absolutely delicious. This is sort of, it's got an acidity on the foretaste, hasn't it? But it's got a real chocolatey, heavy feel to it as well.
I had no plans for a Sunday roast this afternoon, but I'm rapidly thinking.
I'm just going to carry on drinking.
Yeah, lamb, rosemary.
Eating's cheating, Steve.
No. Eating will make it better. Isabel, nice roast lamb with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Roast lamb would be perfect. How would you describe this, Isabel?
So I love the leathery nature. You know, 2006 has actually got a nice bottle age on the wine that you would call, you know, the development or the tertiary aromas, if you wanted to sort of be a bit more technical. But, you know, I just love the personality of this wine. You know, it's... when you taste it, it does really transport you to Mediterranean climate. You get that warmth, you know, like really, really deep, rich sort of ripe fruits. And you do want to sit down and have like a beautiful piece of lamb or a nut roast. Let's give a, you know, if you're
I'll leave
really
them out of it, Isabel. Come off it. or a nice sprig of celery. Only good for stirring a Bloody Mary, come on.
And you know, the great thing about these wines is because they are actually really solid in terms of if you open them, you can drink them over a week or a couple of weeks. You know, they're not going to go off. They've got a lot of immunity. Their immune system is brilliant because they come from very vibrant, alive grapes. So you can just pop the cork, you know. I mean, not that you would do that. I suspect that you probably polish the bottle off in... probably one sitting, but were you to not...
That was my first question.
it will just stay really in great condition for a week or 2 weeks, which is great for a restaurant if you're serving it by the glass, for example.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask, before we leave, we're going to wrap it up in a second, sadly. I don't really want to... Should we just sack off the rest of the show?
We could just sit here and drink, you mean?
Yeah.
No, we'll carry on.
The labelling, Isabel, of the bottles, how important is that, the sort of brand of these small manufacturers? Because the red that we've tasted, the Corbière, Ledogard, it's an old-fashioned label. It's a classic label. The Sicilian wine we drank is quite funky, isn't it? Like, how, is Do you find that these artisan wines tend to brand themselves differently to sort of your average wine?
Yeah, I think they are quite. They have a great sense of humour. So very often you'll find, you know, something quite humorous or funny on the label. They tend to be very minimalist. Mm. You know, I think yes, because you know, I think it reflects the art and craft and labour of love that goes on in the vineyard in the winery. And I think people do actually take a great care of her packaging. And sometimes they'll mention, you know, this wine has been made without anything. So they are, I think for them, the label is a great way to communicate, you know, the story of the wine.
Yeah. No, because they're all handsome bottles, all really rather different. Mm. No, they're beautiful. Well, Isabel, we're going to have to leave it there.
Oh.
Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your expertise and your booze.
And your suitcase.
I've got loads more in my suitcase. Suitcase Look, of we could booze. Just go on and on. I've got about six bottles, but
we've got to speak to Rockstar in a minute.
Why don't you hang around for a little bit? Yeah. We'll speak to Rockstar and then we can have, you know, that roast.
Exactly.
I'm going to make a roast.
Not a roast.
I'm not going to make a
roast.
I've
got a dash anyway.
Isabel Legeron, master of wine and boss of the Raw Wine Festival here at the Truman Brewery in London. Thank you so much for coming and sharing your expertise on the weekly.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Coming up next, we're going to be speaking to Charlatans' Tim Burgess about Indie Label Store Day after this promo.
In Tasmania, talented craftspeople are making use of the island's natural materials to design and build furniture and ceramics. Monocle video journalist Gabriel Lee toured the island to meet the designer makers putting Tasmania's personality on the map.
It seemed to me that if I was going to make pots at this time and in this culture, I needed to say something about being here and now. And the way to do that was through the materials.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films from affairs to business, culture to design in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Thank you very much for tuning in to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Steve Bloomfield. We just were entertained by Isabel Legeron.
We really were. She was fantastic.
Wasn't she wonderful? I've got two glasses.
You now seem to have two glasses of wine in front of you. I only have the one. I'm still on the Mungibele.
Yes, we like this. We're working.
Mungibele.
We're on the Sicilian. Mm. She was lovely. We're definitely going to get her back in. You're definitely going to hear more from her on Monocle 24. First, before we speak to Tim Burgess, Steve,
which I'm very excited about.
I thought I'd set up Tim Burgess for maybe some of our listeners in other corners of the world, although they're a big band. I know they played Fuji Rock and things like that, I'm sure. We're going to be speaking to Tim Burgess in a minute, who's the lead singer of The Charlatans. So I'm going to be a bit selfish and play my favourite song by them. This is A Man Needs to Be Told. Man Needs to Be Told. That is such a good song. I loved hearing that again by The Charlatans. And aren't we lucky? The man himself's on the line. Tim Burgess is a singer best known as a mouthpiece of those perennial British indie favourites, The Charlatans. But he's also a regular commentator on the state of indie music and labels. And it's that hunger for obscure pop treats that puts him on a market stall at London's independent label market at Spitalfields this weekend. The event yesterday saw mid-sized industry players such as XL Records, Domino, Bella Union and Rough Trade getting back to what they do best, selling bundles of mysterious and promising vinyl to committed fans. And Tim joins us on the line now. Tim, hi.
How are you doing? You all right?
I'm all right. I'm very well. Thank you very much. You smell lovely. I hear you're fresh out the shower.
Yeah. I'm just like, you know, I'm just bouncing around all over the place at the moment. So I'm just kind of like on my way somewhere and leaving somewhere else. But I'm good.
And you're busy. You're busy this weekend with the indie label market at Spitalfields. Yeah. Have you got your? I'm assuming you've got not on right now. That's probably a dressing gown. But I'm imagining you've got on a kind of pouch for change. You've got your fivers in one. You've got your coins in another because you're going to be selling records this weekend. Literally.
Yeah. You know. I mean. I'm feeling pretty good about it. It's my first one.
Yeah.
I've got a fanny pack, I think they're called.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a bum bag.
A bum bag, depending on where you're from. And, I'm really looking forward to it. Got 20 Nick Colt Void singles off hot off the press. Cool. And some posters and all the rest of the Ogenesis catalogue.
Yeah, so tell us about the label, Tim. Ogenesis. It's a nice name. You guys were on Beggars, weren't you? Who are the kind of sort of flagship indie labels. But you've gone even more indie.
Well, I don't know about even more indie, but I mean, I thought Ogenesis was a good name, you know, about the beginning and you know, that so a fresh thing should start as a seed, you know, and see what it grows into. So I thought that would be a, I don't know whether it's more indie or just something that's very kind of small.
It sounds very natural.
It is natural because, I mean, things have happened by chance. Mm. And it's kind of, you know, if you don't exactly know what you're doing, then things have to happen by chance anyway, and I kind of like that. It's, you know, I feel, you know, as excited about starting this label as I did when I first joined a band. So
yeah, that's cool. And what sort of, you have to sort of be on the other side of it, don't you? I mean, you kind of, are you do you make a good shopkeeper as much as a good rock star?
I had a really great chat with one of my heroes, Bruce Mitchell, the drummer from Jurassic Column, and I told him that I'd been, he asked me what I'd been up to, and I said recently I've been roading for Factory 4.
Right.
He said, I think that's a brilliant thing because you have to see it from every aspect. And I thought, you know, coming from a 70-year-old legend, I thought that was a really great thing for him to say, and I really am starting to appreciate that more and more. The fact that, you know, people love vinyl and there's a chance for, you know, labels all to get together and sell their wares is a really wonderful thing, and at Spitalfields Market it's a great place to do it. So.
The book Telling Stories has been much talked about. Can we ask you about it? What was it? Is it a cathartic exercise, kind of dishing the dirt on yourself, basically, man?
Cathartic? No, because that's not what I went into it for. I didn't really, you know, want to kind of exercise any demons or anything like that. I wanted to write an honest book about certain events that I remembered, really.
And and the bits in between, the bits you remembered, would just have to remain a mystery.
Now the bits that I didn't kind of remember or weren't at the forefront of my mind, because again it was a very natural process. They just hidden in the back of my mind somewhere. So I'm sure they'll come up for another. I'm not saying another book, but another story somewhere. Yeah. Whether it's written just, you know, as a blog or whatever, you know.
Is it a fun process? I mean, obviously, you know, writing lyrics, you're writing riffs, but then you have to promo these whole things. Is writing a book kind of a different sort of speed of work when you've got, you know, 300 pages or however long you want to write this thing? It's a very different sort of creative process, isn't it? Was it quite a refreshing one?
It was a refreshing one, and you're right, it's completely different. Everything has to be specific, really, whereas with writing lyrics, you know, it can come, you know, it's a very kind of dreamy like thing, and it doesn't have to make any sense at all, you know, whereas in a book it has to be kind of written properly, and I'm not a writer, so you know, the whole thing was very experimental at the beginning, and you know, I had to find a kind of way of doing it, and it came out, I was completely satisfied, you know, I mean, but yeah, I haven't read it through since, so I mean, I might be mortified when I look at it again, you know.
Well, it's true, and no one listens. Everyone you ask, any musician, you know, and they always say they never listen to their albums, so maybe it's the right thing to do. You kind of give birth and you put your kid out in the world, right, in a way.
I listened to Some Friendly when we did a retrospective, and I listened to Telling Stories recently because we're doing, you know, some gigs in the summer. But I don't listen to my records now. I mean, after we first, you know, have them mastered or something like that, we probably listen to them because it's quite exciting. But then you kind of go on tour and you just put them somewhere else. You know, you just put them aside really, and then look forward.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us on the weekly.
Thanks, cheers. Thank you.
Well, I love Tim Jones. He's excellent. And from a man needs to be told, we're going to go back to Cuba. This is Juan Formel with Ezequiel Anda. Who liked that? Do you like that?
I like that.
Let's just try and quickly find what it was.
On the back of the CD.
Isel Keander by Juan Formel. This is how you should do it. This is nice. It's nice. I think I should go to places where you can't answer your emails more often.
Yeah.
Principally, because you bring back lots of nice CDs under your arm and you don't quite know what's what. But that's I think, what you call classic Cuban samba. I basically picked that up from a record store in Cuba.
Because it had the Cuban flag on.
Because it kind of looks like a nice album.
Can I ask about this?
That's not gay porn.
It's a CD, DVD. It does look like... look like gay porn. El Malcrio?
That is reggaeton. We're going to have that later on in the show.
La Voz.
That sounds much better than it looks. We're going to play that later.
It's basically a guy with tattoos and muscles and no clothes.
And really bad haircut.
And really, really bad haircut. Like the sort of haircut that kids at my school had in the early 90s was sort of the tram tracks.
He's doing a pose, but he looks a bit like he looks like a bouncer gone to seed.
Yes.
Or a member of E17. Anyway, Steve, you're going to set up. We've got Lucinda Lampson coming on next. We can't leave her waiting, can we?
We can't.
Tell us about Lucinda.
I can, indeed. This week, a new architectural landmark emerged in Ichihara City. The biggest inland ever created, the new public toilet. Oh, yes, it's a public toilet.
Goodness.
Occupies space in front of Itabu Station on the Kominato railway line. It's boxed in transparent glass and sits in the middle of a spacious garden of potted flowers and plants, as, you know, most toilets should. The garden is walled for a bit of privacy, but the design's panoramic view for the occupant is something of a new twist for those spending a penny. Joining us on the line now is photographer and architectural commentator Lucinda Lampton, author of such tomes as Temples of Convenience, A History of the Lavatory. Lucinda, very warm welcome to Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
What do you make of this new twist in the tale of the toilet?
It's not terrific. It's not totally new, because there have been many sitting in gardens. They've usually been walled in, and there was one the year before last on the embankment that was the same, a glass box in which you sat. And the magic of that was, I couldn't find it out about this one, the magic of that one, or the way you went and sat on the lowered yourself onto the pan in a glass box. It was one-way vision. So although you could see everybody looking at you, as it were, they weren't. They couldn't see you, and you were. It was bought by a woman called Monica Bonvicini, and it was all over London. I mean, it was in the London embankment. It was hot news, and everyone went to stare at people sitting on it, but couldn't see them. And I don't know. I couldn't read. Have you read it? If you can be seen or not, I couldn't understand it. There seem to be curtains, don't there?
I think there are curtains. Yes, to sort of protect one's modesty. But still, I mean, I think the idea of relieving oneself with the potential of an audience perhaps won't be everyone's cup of tea.
Not at all everyone's cup of tea. Absolutely, blinking well not. And also, you'd feel incredibly vulnerable, wouldn't you?
This sounds like a one-off, Lucinda. Is there any history of anything like this?
Well, that one on the embankment.
In this one in Japan, in this garden.
Yeah, but it's exactly the same. I mean, it's the same as the one on the embankment. It's a glass box, exactly the same as that, but it not in a garden. That's the only thing. So actually more frightening, because it was in the London streets. But sitting in a garden, no. I mean, I don't know, William Morris had one sitting in his garden, but it was part of the architecture and the look of the place. So there hasn't been one built beautifully in the middle of the garden. I'm just thinking as I speak slowly. No, not one. No, no, no.
And what, because the Japanese, without wanting to without wanting to be culturally reductive, they're very into their bogs.
Terrifically so.
We have these Toto toilets in the Monocle
offices. What are they?
Well, these ones that sort of spray you, clean you,
deodorize
you. Yeah.
Heated seats.
Heated seats, exactly. It's like sitting in a nice sort of Mercedes-Benz, isn't it? Something.
Do you do in a Mercedes-Benz?
Have heated seats. Do you find that the Japanese are, you know, in your temples of convenience and other works, have you found that the Japanese, for example, there's a lot of material there?
By repute. I've never been there, and I've never sat on one. And by repute, they're the cleanest and the most odorously delightful, and the most modern and the most comfortable. Yes, without any question about that. But I've never been to one. There was this curious one. Just remember, I wonder what happened. There was one in Reading and one in London that came out of the ground in the middle of the night for drunkards, for pub people out of the pub, and it was a urinal that sprung up. It was a uniloo. It was for men and for women, and it came out of the ground at 11 o'clock at night, and stayed there for people to use until dawn when it was lowered into the ground again. I wonder what's happened to that.
Wow.
that is quite a spectacular toilet.
I think we found the world's worst job, cleaning the underground pissoir. What can we tell, Lucinda, about the peoples of the world by their lavatorial habits, do you think?
What can I tell? Nothing. My expertise is in England. It definitely is. I can't think of anything except as a very strange phenomenon that I've come across is I spent many years in Jamaica, and they were the cleanest and most odour-free of any I ever went to, wherever they were. That was a strange thing. However poor the town, however grim, and however dirty in the streets, you had these havens of sweet smell, like walking into a stable with sweet-smelling hay. I mean, it was that feeling. It was sort of a strange thing, that, wasn't it? The public lavatories of Jamaica were the very best.
And tell us, how has the sort of the lavatory evolved over the past 100 years? I mean, what's different now about, you know, from how we used to go to the toilet 100 years ago?
More than 100. It was one was invented for Queen Elizabeth. Well, the Romans here. Those are the earliest ones here. The Romans sat on as many as 20 men side by side, relishing in each other's company rather than recoiling from it all with their pants down in a row. And they had a channel of water in front of them, into which they dipped a communal sponge stick and passed it round, clean their private parts, and then passed it round. And then one slave was so humiliated by having to clean out the lavatory, he committed suicide by pushing such a sponge stick down his throat one day. That was a bad thing. Oh God,
what a way to go.
I know, what a way to go. Anyway, then it stayed on for years and till the 1700s with holes in the ground and being very... very, very basic. And then in the 1700s, they started to have sort of simple machines. And then by the 1800s, it was full work, as we know it today. 1874 is the one that was invented, the one we still use today. Oh, I know what I've missed out, a very important thing. The Queen Elizabeth was designed, one was made for Queen Elizabeth by her godson, Sir John Harrington. It was a full, proper working one with a cistern and everything. And she was too frightened of it. She said it was like a thunderstorm and she wouldn't have anything to do with it. And so she never used it. And another 250 years went by before they were used again, which is extraordinary. It was invented that long ago.
There's Royal Plumbing's interesting stuff down at the Royal Pavilion in Brighton. There's some amazing, that was sort of like cutting edge plumbing, I think, done in there. But basically, it was back in those days, Elizabethan, when you'd sort of crap out the window, essentially.
Yeah, straight out onto people's heads. And there's a castle in Northumberland called Chipchase Castle, which was stopped being used in about 1160 or something of that, as early as that. It was very, very early, and then they left it. And the stains are still down the walls. All that time ago. And then there was a very horrible job you had, which was called a gang farmer, which was the person who used to scrape these chutes and clean it up every night. That was a bad job. That was a very bad job indeed. But interesting the way they were all together. I found many 5-seaters, 6-seaters, 7-seaters, 10-seaters all over the country. Many, many, many 2-seaters. I wouldn't like to go to a 2, never mind a 10, would you?
No.
I wouldn't want to. I know, high-fiving people are having a sort of deeper, meaningful conversation. How's the wife? While you're on the throne. Lucinda, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for enlightening us about...
Delighting you. I'm glad. Such a favourite subject.
Author of Temples of Convenience and other selected works. Lucinda Lambton, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. That's about it, Steve.
That's it.
Edition 150 of the Monocle Weekly. We started hotly with Isabelle Legeron.
Yes, indeed. And she left her wine.
And she did leave her wine.
Which is very nice
of
her.
Listeners of the show might possibly have been able to detect by the end of the show.
No.
Okay,
no.
Good. All right.
Not at all.
Well, happy anniversary, Stevie.
Thank you very much, Bobby.
And that's all for this Sunday's edition of the Monocle Weekly here in London. Today's show was produced by Paul Noble and the researcher was Tom Hall. We're back next week at the same time, same place, Steve.
Right here.
Meet me here?
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah,
it's quite fun, isn't it? We'll crack open some wine, we'll do it the same.
Oh, I'm not here next week.
Oh, you're not? Actually, no. I'm in Azerbaijan.
I'm in Sicily.
Okay, nice work for
because
some.
Because they have nice wine.
They do. Go and bring us back a case of that one. But for now, from all of us here at the Monocle Weekly, I'm Robert Band.
I'm Steve Bloomfield.
Thanks for tuning in.